Today on Vox Talks Economics, the intended and unintended effects of profit sharing. Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded live at the Centre for Economic Policy Research Paris Symposium 2023. My name is Tim Phillips. When firms share a portion of their profits with their employees, does it make the employees better off? And what's the effect on the firm? David Tesmar of the MIT Sloan School is one of the authors of a paper that investigates this for French firms, and he joins me now. David, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
In general, how common is this practice of profit sharing?
In most countries, this is a voluntary thing that companies choose. So companies around the world, back in the 80s, 90s, in Japan, in Germany, even in the US, in a sense, you would imagine that, you know, given the prevalence of stock options, for instance, in the tech sector, that's a way to share profits with your employees. So that happens on a voluntary basis in many countries and, you know, in many firms.
What's the theory behind it? If it's working well, how do the workers benefit and how does the firm benefit?
I think the idea for these voluntary schemes is that the company is doing well, you share the spoils of war with the employees, and then they're happier and they work harder and productivity goes up. And so that's the general outcome of those studies that have been studying those firms and those schemes around the world, is that companies that tend to adopt these profit-sharing schemes tend to increase their productivity. That's kind of the baseline fact. We're talking about companies that choose to do it. So it's hard to know whether, you know, they choose to share because they're doing better than before. It's not clear.
And if it doesn't work as intended, what are the bad things that could happen?
Of course, then, you know, if you have to share, if you put in place a system that forces your shareholder to share like all of their profits with their workers, then, you know, they're going to earn less. And as a result, you know, we're going to reduce the incentives to invest. So that's the big cost, the downside. It's something that is costly to shareholders, but of course, they might think it's worth it if that increases productivity or worker satisfaction.
It can be quite hard, I guess, to work out whether profit sharing does cause these effects, because it tends not to be random whether firms choose to profit share. From the evidence that you've got where there's voluntary profit sharing, can we say very much about the effects of it?
So not so much, it turns out. I mean, our study is on mandatory profit sharing. It's a different sort of profit sharing. You know, that's when the government comes in and tells your boss, you need to share X percent of your profits with your workers and you have no choice, otherwise you go to jail. So this is what we're studying. This is what's happening in France. So there is a scheme that's in place, has been in place since the 60s, in fact, whose purpose was to make, you know, workers and capitalists, you know, getting along better. I judge whether that worked out or not, on that front at least, given the number of strikes and political opposition to capitalism in this country. But what's for sure is that this system was mandatory for a certain category of firms, over 100 employees and then 50 employees in the 90s, and optional for the other category of firms. And so we can see that some of these firms actually did choose to share their profits with their workers. But it's a minority. It's really a small minority.
In December 2023, an episode in our Climate Finance series investigated whether the sole purpose of a firm was to maximize its profit. And if not, what other goals could it have? Listen to What is the Purpose of a Company? With guest Dirk Schulmacher.
So let's talk about this research into mandatory profit sharing. As you say, it started off in the 60s for firms with 100 employees or more. How much of the profits are they sharing? How big a difference did this make?
Quite a bit, actually. In the French system, you have, it depends on what kind of firm you are, but if you are the typical average firm in our sample, you have to share about 10% of your profits with the workers. So that's a big fraction.
It's still, I would imagine, be quite hard to analyze if we wanted to look at this in a causal way, surely, because for all the firms in a category, they're all sharing their profits. There's no counterfactual. That must be difficult.
Yeah, so we do have that counterfactual in two ways. First, because we know that, you know, companies above a certain threshold have to comply with that scheme and companies below that threshold don't. And mm-hmm. so you can compare those companies that have 99 employees and 101 employees. And, you know, they're supposed to be rather similar, yet, you know, one is forced to share, the other one isn't. And what we see is that companies try to avoid being in the category where they are forced to share, of course, you know. So if you have the choice between having 101 employees or 99 employees, you go for 99 and you stay too small for too long. I mean, marginally mm-hmm. smaller, of course. So there's that. The dimension of the analysis that helps you assert causality is the fact that the law has changed in the late 80s. So in 1990, the threshold above which you have to comply with the profit sharing scheme went down from 100 to 50. And uh-huh. so all firms that had between 50 and 100 employees suddenly had to share their profits, while companies that were above 100 always had to before and after, and companies that were below 50 employees never had to. So we have two control groups, never treated, always treated, and in the middle, companies that suddenly had to share.
In your analysis, you have to have some quite detailed accounting and wages data, don't you? Where do you get that from?
So that's the beauty of the French system, is that the census data, so administrative data, are reasonably easy to access, in the sense that, you know, you can, via a certain server, and you can set up an access to both employer-employee data, so you can follow people over time and know how much they make every year. So it can, it's to help us, you know, open the firm and see, you know, who benefits and who doesn't from the profit sharing scheme. And then you have to know whether the company invests, how much profits it's making, etc., like whether sales are growing or not. And that is coming from a separate data set that is in general hard to access, which is, you know, coming from tax files. So companies mm-hmm. filing, you know, those forms are designed to raise the corporate tax, and there they provide all sorts of details about, you know, how much they invest, how much they sell, etc., how much profits they're making, etc. And so that's what we're using, the merger of these two data sets, employee level data plus accounts at the firm level.
We've got three categories of firms, haven't we? We've got the ones over 100 who were sharing profits before, they're sharing profits after, mm-hmm. the ones under 50 who mm-hmm. don't have to share their profits at all, and then the ones for whom the regime changed.
Absolutely.
First question, the big one, I guess. How does profit sharing affect the worker compensation? Do they end up earning more money?
So the first pass is to look at the average worker in the firm. So the average mm-hmm. worker in the firm has now two sources of compensation, the wage that he or she had before, plus now a slice of profits that wasn't there before. So what we see is that wages don't come down, they stay the same before and after the reform. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all increase, you know, both in the control groups and in the treatment groups. So, you know, they don't behave any differently. But you're adding on top of wages that are not decreasing a slice of profits. And so total compensation goes up. You might expect, you know, many of us or people that typically read this paper tend to expect that maybe now that you have to pay your workers with that slice of profit, when you're going to hire new workers, you're going to offer them a lower wage. And so the average mm-hmm. wage is going to go down to exactly compensate, offset the profit slice. We don't see any of that. Average salaries don't go down, so total compensation.
Why do they not go down?
So there can be like several explanations. What we seem to find is something consistent with the idea that it's hard to bring wages down, even for new hires. You could say, okay, it doesn't happen to existing workers, because existing workers, you cannot go to them and tell them, okay, the government forces me to give you, I don't know, 10,000 euros every year. So I'm going to reduce your salary by 10,000 euros. That's a hard sell. And obviously, like, very few firms would do it. However, you would expect it for new hires. So the new hires would be paid the same package as before, and maybe you would expect that maybe companies would try to cut down on wages a little bit. We don't see any evidence of that. Why could that be? One possibility is that it's hard to bring salaries down when people are hired close to the minimum wage. Aside from Luxembourg, in proportion to the average wage, the French minimum wage is the highest in the world. Mm-hmm. So obviously, what is the impact of this? The impact is very simple, is that a lot of people nowadays, between 30 and 40% of the workforce, is actually paid at the minimum wage. So minimum wage is what it is. You cannot reduce it.
Yes.
So now you have to add a slice of profits. You cannot reduce the wage. This is what happens.
Does this change for the high-paid employees?
The answer is for the high-paid employees, they're far away from the minimum wage.
Yeah.
So what we see in our data is that wages tend to come down to offset the increased compensation coming from the profit slice that they're getting. Mm-hmm. The evidence that we have for various reasons, we're getting down at a very granular level because we're looking at employees, you know, within the firm, and we don't have that many. So, but the evidence that we have is consistent with the idea that total compensation for skilled workers doesn't increase, while total compensation for very unskilled workers does increase.
One of the arguments that you stated in favor of profit sharing is that it increases productivity because everyone has a stake in the success of the firm. Mm-hmm. Did you find an impact on productivity?
So we did not at all. We found no effect on productivity. Hmm. I think people have two effects in mind in the literature. So one is you have a share of the profits. So the bigger the profits, the wealthier you're going to be. So it makes you work harder. But when you have 100 employees, there's very little control you have over company's profit. And so what Richard Freeman, for instance, the Harvard professor, used to say back in the days is that profit sharing works because it forces workers to enter some kind of reciprocity agreement where give them more money. And so they feel compelled to actually work harder to reciprocate the good deed that you did. In our situation, that thing cannot happen because shareholders are forced to share their profits. So there is no, you know, gift, counter-gift kind of a dynamic taking place. It's really not a gift that they're receiving, so they don't feel like they have to work harder in a sense. So I guess that's because it's mandatory that we don't see anything on productivity. I mean, to be honest, we don't know for sure, but that's a possibility.
One of the arguments against profit sharing is it discourages investments because what would be the return to that investment is actually now being given to the workers. Again, have you seen this?
So we don't either. So it doesn't seem to discourage investment. And in fact, it's not so much of a surprise when you look into the detail of the reform. So the reform is well designed in the sense that you have to share something that is not exactly your profits, but your profits minus the rental cost of capital, something that is, you know, the cost of renting the capital that the company has. Mm-hmm. It's any profit above 5% of the company's equity. And so if 5% is what shareholders tend to get, it doesn't create a distortion. So you're essentially not distorting investment because, of course, you're taxing the future profits of investment more because when people are going to invest, they're going to receive smaller profits. But the cost of that investment is going to be deducted from the tax base too. So it's going to be reduced too. So you're going to reduce the benefits, reduce the cost. And so that's going to be neutral or almost neutral in the design. And so that doesn't create that many distortions for existing firms. I'm not saying it creates no distortions for newly created firms, but for existing firms, we don't find evidence of distortion. And that's something that's kind of consistent with the law. So in the paper, we have a little model that kind of makes it clear. But the idea is that you tax profits and you tax costs of investing. So you tax both. So that cancels out.
Very often with policies when they've been around for a long time, we sort of forget why they were introduced in the first place, or we stop looking at what they're achieving. From your analysis here, is this policy doing what it was intended to do? Can we say what this policy is achieving now?
It's a good question. So the initial logic behind this policy, which was designed by the General de Gaulle back in the 60s, so before he left power, 67. So his vision was French capitalism in some kind of a third way, communism and Anglo-Saxon unfettered capitalism, whatever that means. And so the third way would be something where workers would be co-owners of the firm, in a sense. Reconcile them with their bosses. As I said earlier, I don't think I had that part has worked all that well. But definitely unions were very happy about the scheme because they thought, you know, that's a new source of money that we're going to get for our employees. And that part did work, actually. So without reconciling workers with capitalism, we actually make them wealthier through this scheme, especially when they are at the bottom of the pay scale towards the minimum wage.
Well, thank you. It's a fascinating insight into how large-scale policy works. Good talking to you. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
The paper is called The Effects of Mandatory Profit Sharing on Workers and Firms, Evidence from France. The authors are Elio Nimia David, David Schreier and David Tesmar.
This has been a Vox Talk, recorded at the CEPR Paris Symposium. When you're checking Instagram, look for clips of past episodes at Vox Talks Economics. And follow us wherever you get your podcasts, we're there. And if you like what you hear, why not leave us a review too? Next week on Vox Talks Economics, the long shadow of the Spanish Civil War.